Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now is CNN commentator Jack Cafferty. Many of you saw him on Channel 4 during his years as a local news anchor and Live at 5 host. These days he does his Cafferty Files commentaries on CNN's The Situation Room, and he has a new book about the presidential race and other things called It's Getting Ugly Out There, published by Wiley. And our phones are open for your reactions to anything Barack Obama said or to talk to Jack Cafferty at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Jack, welcome to WNYC.
Nice to be with you, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So you just heard our Barack Obama interview, and you write positively about Obama in your book. You say he's got the visionary uplift of a Kennedy or a Truman. That's a quote. You think he could redeem America's place in the world as a positive because he's now seen positively around the world. And you fantasize, you even fantasize about a third-party ticket of Obama and Colin Powell.
Well, it was more than a fantasy. We actually posed that as a question on the Situation Room a couple, 3 months back. And the response was overwhelming to the upside, very positive. There's a lot of respect for those two men in the country. And when we posed the question, would you vote for a third-party ticket of Colin Powell and or Barack Obama, without specifying which one would necessarily even be at the top of the ticket, we got thousands of emails from people all over the country saying, you bet.
Overwhelmingly yes, as a percentage.
Absolutely. Very, very positive reaction.
And obviously an unscientific poll, but what do you think the response says?
Well, I think the response says that the country is beginning to catch on to the fact that there's nothing new under the sun. Was that Truman said that? Somebody a long time ago said that. And when it comes to national politics in this country, it's just the same old dialogue, campaign after campaign. We have to do something about health care. We have to do something about the deficits. We have to do something about the war.
But we do have to do something about health care and the deficits.
I understand, but nothing has been done about them for years and years and years, which is the reason that we're approaching a critical stage in both those areas. And despite all the protestations to the contrary, the government continues to ignore this stuff, except when they're trying to be elected to something. You know,
and any reaction to anything Obama said in particular in that interview?
No, I agree with him about Ahmadinejad. I thought it was a mistake to give him a platform to speak. He's a worm. I mean, he's not worthy of anybody's attention for more than 8 seconds. And if you really have a burning hunger to find out what that little clown thinks about anything, you can go on Al Jazeera and probably get a full dose of it. I thought it was fairly disingenuous of Columbia University to invite the guy. I think there's better use they could make of their resources and their facilities. He's here to address the U.N. Let him make a speech to the U.N. and go home. I mean, who needs this guy?
But Obama was really more critical of the media, as I understood him. I think he was saying, okay, Columbia has academic freedom, they can do what they want, but, you know, let's face it, it was some of the same networks, including cable news channels, CNN was not the worst offender, who went on and on about how it was wrong of Columbia to give them a platform. And then, you know, the cable news channels broadcasted all over the world. You didn't have to do that.
Well, it was news. When the president of Iran, who has advocated the destruction of Israel and who is suspected of developing nuclear weapons, comes to an American university and is given a platform to speak his vitriol and tell his lies, that's news. Just like it was news when Fidel Castro came here, just like it was news when Nikita Khrushchev came here. And so what we do is cover the news, and Mr. Ahmadinejad's appearance at Columbia qualifies as news.
One thing that jumped out at me from Obama, I asked him why his health care plan is better than Hillary Clinton's, and he said they're 95% the same, but it's a question more of who you trust to really implement and be independent of the medical industry lobby. So he was trying to emphasize personal character over the specifics of his policy as the reason to vote for him.
Well, I think if there's anything that makes him attractive as a candidate, it's the fact that he stands out in that way. He's a refreshing face. He's somebody new. To my knowledge, he's uncorrupted by the system at this point. And, I think the country is probably hungry for somebody who can deliver on on the kind of thing he was talking about. As a practical matter, whether he can or not remains to be seen. The fact of the matter is the military-industrial complex that Dwight Eisenhower warned us about 50 years ago has a stranglehold on this country, and the big corporations control the agenda and the legislation and the campaigns and the government, and we're just kind of watching the parade go by now.
Robert in New Hyde Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you? Jack, you're always great when you're in New York, and you've always been a great reporter, and I look forward to reading the book.
Well, thank you, Robert. Buy two, you might lose one.
Just always trying to increase sales, huh?
Yeah, you bet. That's why we're here.
I think I agree with you, Jack, and part of the thing was that the discussion in anybody's employment and so forth, I've kind of negated any discussion that I've had about the Columbia presentation because right here, we've been a little guilty of beating a dead horse about it, because when you went into the discussion with Obama about health care and other types of issues that we have both domestically and globally, yes, the Middle East is an issue, but we've got an issue across the globe, and also things like the health care, which you drill down, are important. And I think when we talk about the he hit the nail on the head in closing the interview with you when he said, the media and in general have given too much attention to this. And being a commuter into New York, I can tell you that it's also not appreciative of the way it's clogged up the roadways.
Well, that's the UN in general, right?
Well, that's true. But then again, when we've got such a high-profile issue in regard to the sensitivity of you know, how we're sensitive to the New York threat, it's increased things also. But I think Obama does have, being a New Yorker, when I compare that, you know, a lot of folks are swayed by Hillary, who's kind of brought a little bit of an awe as far as, you know, in fact, one of the things that one of the news outlets were guilty of is they quoted Michelle Obama inappropriately saying that Clinton wasn't the best for the job. And the actual quote was, she said, nobody is best for the job just because of race or gender.
All right, Robert, thank you. I'm going to leave it there. Appreciate it. My guest on WNYC, Jack Cafferty, his new book, It's Getting Ugly Out There. You may know him from his CNN commentaries. On the Obama thing and Columbia, he says he supports academic freedom but would not have invited him if he were president of the university, but would meet with him as president of the United States with no preconditions. That's a lot of positions to unpack. Does it all hang together for you?
Not really. Ahmadinejad's role, if he has one at all, is as a member of the international community and dealing with our government and the other governments that he interacts with in the Middle East. It's not to come here at the behest of Columbia University and be given a platform to stand there and spew this vitriol that is the hallmark of what he's all about. We got to remember, too, and I'm sure Columbia University knows this, they just chose to ignore it, Ahmadinejad's a figurehead. Ayatollah Khomeini is the power in Iran, and Ahmadinejad probably does exactly what he's told by the Ayatollah. So, you know, and like I said, I'm sure Columbia knew that. Columbia, I think, made a big mistake,
But there are people on the other side, too, who say, look, for all the outrage over Ahmadinejad being invited to Colombia, he's not even the head of state. He is just a figurehead. Khamenei has the real power, as you say. And so what's all the fuss about just Ahmadinejad?
Well, because I think Colombia was looking to see if they couldn't get a little protest going, get some news cameras up there, get a little publicity for themselves. And
that's one step too cynical, isn't it? You don't think that's really what it was all about?
Well,
for Colombia,
what's the purpose? What was the reason? What purpose was served by that event? You tell me.
Well, I don't want to go round and round on this because we've done it for a couple of days on the show.
Well,
but to me, as the president of the university that has one of the leading international and public affairs schools in the country, training the future foreign policy officials of the United States, maybe the former future secretaries of state. Obama went to Columbia. That's the caliber of person. Maybe it serves an academic function. Maybe they learn more by being exposed to an Ahmadinejad. They're not giving him a Pulitzer Prize. They're exposing their students to someone like him who they're going to have to deal with when they go into that profession.
Fine.
Jack Cafferty with us. And does that mean I convinced you?
No.
You say another good thing about Obama in your book. The biggest knock on him is generally that he's inexperienced. But you write that you see that mostly as a good thing.
Well, I mentioned that earlier in this discussion that, to my knowledge, he so far is uncorrupted by the system and represents a bit of a breath of fresh air when it comes to the political status quo. I mean, take a look at the candidates we have. It's the same collection of ne'er-do-wells that, you know, that have been tying up the national debate for the last 30 years. The last, how many, 25, 26 years we've had a Clinton or a Bush in the White House? I mean, give me a break here. We've got 300 million people in this country. Let's find somebody who's got some new ideas.
And you put the fear about Obama's inexperience that you do have in a very interesting way. Not that he may not be up to the job, but that, quote, we don't want the Joint Chiefs of Staff leading him around by his neck, unquote. So is that reminiscent of what you think happened to Bush?
No, not so much. I think, you know, if he's as smart as he so far seems to indicate to us that he is, then he'll surround himself with the kind of people that will compensate for whatever lack of national and or international experience he has in the beginning. I mean, Ronald Reagan was arguably one of the most successful presidents in the country's history. And yet, you know, it was due as much to the efforts of the people that he surrounded himself with as it was to his own expertise in things like international relations. Reagan was a charismatic figure who could lead. And if you can do that, then the rest of it's pretty easy.
You write in the book about your metamorphosis on President Bush. You were a Bush-supporting, compassionate, conservative war hawk. What happened?
Well, I found out we were lied to. The whole country was behind Bush. Bush had a 90-plus percent approval rating after 9/11. He squandered the greatest public support of perhaps any president in this country, maybe since Roosevelt during World War II, and I don't even know if they measured that stuff that far back. But the country would have gone anywhere and done anything for George Bush. When he stood on that pile of rubble down at Ground Zero with that bullhorn speaker in his hand and said to the firemen, the people who knock down these buildings are going to hear from all of us in short order, I was ready to go reenlist in the service and put my uniform back on and go kill somebody. But it turns out we were being played big time, and as that dawned on me, it was like, hey, wait a minute. You know, you took pretty disgusting advantage of a national tragedy to further your own political and personal agenda, and you led us into war with a country that had not done anything to the United States. I mean, Iraq wasn't going anywhere. They were nailed down with no-fly zones. Saddam Hussein had the domestic situation more than under control. Yeah, he was a bad guy. The world's got a lot of bad people in it. But the fact of the matter is, Iraq was not a threat to this country at the time we invaded, and we invaded. This is not a war on terror. This is an invasion followed by an army of occupation in the middle of a civil war in Iraq. And so, you know, my views changed as the circumstances changed.
Gary in Queens, you're on WNYC with Jack Cafferty. Hello.
Howdy. There was a pundit who came out with a book, and he's doing a book tour, and he used to be on the different cable shows. And he said something that I found interesting. He said that the segment producers would love it when he showed emotion rather than make a debating point. So I remember you were an anchor for NBC. You seemed to play it straight down the middle. But I got to ask you, in all seriousness, did CNN, when they hired you, did they ask you to come off as a cranky old left-wing curmudgeon?
The pundit you're referring to?
You know, I forgot his name, but he worked for Fox and MSNBC. It was about a year ago.
No, but you don't know his name.
Well, what about
you would know him by his face and his name readily.
All right.
The answer to your question is no. CNN didn't tell me to do anything.
Okay.
Well, but what, and Gary, thank you for your call. A lot of my listeners watch CNN, but a lot are also disgusted by the whole cable news approach to the issues, the shout fests and the smackdowns and the obsession with the hot buttons. Do you make certain compromises to work in that kind of environment?
No. I'm not involved in any of those things that you just mentioned. I don't get in shoutdowns and smackdowns. I go on the air three times in the afternoon and pose a question that relates to some story that's in the news that day, and solicit emails from viewers and read some of those responses back.
Right, so, that's your role as a commentator on the Situation Room, which is your job.
And that, I mean, that's really the only area of cable news that I'm qualified to discuss is what I do. You know, it's a,
you wouldn't want to comment on kind of the larger place in society of cable news and its tone and its story selection and all of that.
Well, I, you know,
you just don't want to talk badly about your employer?
No, not at all. I have spoken badly about my employer on their air on many occasions, and they have never said a single word to me about it. Does cable news go for the tabloid story and go overboard occasionally? You bet. Does cable news overdo a story, for example, of six people trapped in a mine? I think so. On the other hand, the cable news networks are commercial enterprises that are in a competitive environment and in a position to try to make a profit. We're not, you know, they're not the American Red Cross. They're there to attract viewers, and sometimes they, you know, they get caught up in the hysteria of a story that doesn't have the kinds of significant angles to it that would justify the amount of coverage it gets. So yeah, they're guilty occasionally, but you know, everybody makes mistakes. I mean, it's, you know,
the title of your book is consistent with that kind of tone. It's getting ugly out there. The subtitle is "The Frauds, Bunglers, Liars, and Losers Who Are Hurting America."
And by the way, it's number 14 on the New York Times bestseller list this week.
Yes, so that's I don't know, but that's does it? I don't know. Do you risk being too cynical if you're just writing a lot of people off as bunglers, liars, and losers?
I don't think so. And here's why I say that. I'm 64 years old. I've been in television news for 43 years. I've raised four children. I've paid a mountain's worth of taxes. And I think I'm as qualified as the next guy to look around at my government and my country and respond as viscerally as I choose to what I see. So, you know, I feel a sense of entitlement just brought on by the fact that I'm a cranky old man who's been around a long time.
I think your book just went to number 13. By the way, that caller referred to you as a left-wing curmudgeon. Is that how you would identify?
Absolutely not. I don't take any particular issue with people who want to hang labels on me, but you don't know, and he doesn't either, whether I'm left-wing, right-wing, or somewhere in the middle, and that's fine.
Well, people can characterize you based on, you know, your various opinions. Your job is to express your opinions,
sure.
And you do. Would you call yourself a populist?
Yeah, maybe that's a better word. I mean, I've said some pretty unkind things about the Democrats and about Nancy Pelosi and about Harry Reid and about the fact that the Democratic Party was handed a bit of a mandate in the midterm elections to do something about the war, and they've done absolutely nothing since they won the midterm election. So I kind of am an equal opportunity.
Seems to me, though, that these days you dish it more to the right.
Well, I think at the moment the right's probably causing most of the trouble. But you know, if there's a Democrat elected president, I'll get around to him.
You do seem to basically agree with your fellow populist on CNN, Lou Dobbs, on illegal immigration. So you're kind of a liberal populist on a lot of things, but a conservative populist on that.
Well, on some other things. I mean, I don't think those labels are helpful. I think this country is more divided than it needs to be, and I think one of the reasons is that the politicians have been successful in splitting us up according to our views on things like flag burning and gay marriage and abortion. And we lose sight of the fact that, you know, we're all citizens of the United States, which is arguably the best experiment in democracy and government the world's ever known. But the government, for its own political purposes, the major political parties have created divisions. And you're a liberal and you're a conservative and you're a communist and you're a fascist and you're a this and you're a that. Those are just words and labels. And if you're an intelligent citizen, I think you're probably a little bit of all those things, depending on the particular subject that you're looking at and the consideration it deserves at the time.
Jamie in Vernon, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jamie.
Good morning. I like the name of his book, Getting Ugly Out There. What about every Democratic presidential candidate has called from Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, Al Gore, Barack Obama, they've all called the Bush administration the regime. Yesterday we were just having the big discussion about the Holocaust and everything. We know what that means. How come nobody says anything about that?
They say that, you mean they say the Bush regime instead of the Bush administration?
Yes, that's they call it every time in a stump speech. You hear them say that every single one. I have documented every one of them.
Right. So regime, I guess, indicates some kind of dictatorship. Have you heard that?
Well, yeah, you
and the Republicans call the Democratic Party the Democrat Party.
Yeah, I mean, you know, here we are back to the politics of divide and conquer again. You know, regime, administration, I mean, it's just those are words. What's the difference? I mean, they're either doing the right thing by all of us as citizens or they're not. And in the case of George W. Bush and Dick Five Deferments Cheney and Don Rumsfeld and some of those other players in Washington, I think they've done a lot of damage. I feel like they have. But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't mean they're a regime and not an administration, or an administration and not a regime. It means that they haven't done a very good job running the country.
Let me ask you about yourself. You disclosed that you had a drinking problem, that you come from very dysfunctional parents, 11 marriages between them, a standard Rudy Giuliani could only aspire to.
Hey, hey.
And that your father was a big shot talk show host in Reno, Nevada, but a drunken jerk at home. That's a tough start to life.
Well, it was, yeah. You know, it would have been 12 marriages, but my dad killed one of the fiancés in a drunk driving car accident.
Oh, my.
It was a dysfunctional Irish, sometimes violent household. And one of the reasons, I suppose, that I grew up with a certain question mark when it comes to authority is I found out pretty early on that the authority figures in my life as a child weren't trustworthy, and that, you know, you couldn't depend on them, depending on the degree of chemical alteration they were enduring at the time you had your encounter with them. So, yeah, it was a tough childhood. I started down the same road, drank a lot more than I should have until 20 years ago when I quit, and I'm very proud to say I haven't had a drop since.
So, ironically, good training to be a journalist growing up in a household like that, you seem to be saying.
Maybe. And some street smarts and common sense that you develop out of necessity that don't accrue to people in the Ozzie and Harriet households till a little later in life, if at all.
How does your dysfunctional family background make you look at the various debates over so-called family values?
Well, I just think those things are all rather amusing. I mean, you want to start with Larry Craig? You want to start with the guy who was sending emails to the pages in Washington, D.C.? I mean, family value, what is that? You know, come on. Those are just buzzwords. It's the conservative Republican base, family values. I said on CNN when Larry Craig was caught in a so-called wide stance in the men's room of the airport in Minneapolis, Minnesota, I said, why don't we have a vote in the Senate on whether or not Mr. Craig should remain a member of that august body? Because I want to see how the family values Republican members of the Senate would vote in that instance. And, of course, you're never going to see that ever, 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 because it's one thing to espouse family values. It's another thing to live according to whatever the hell that means. And I just think there's a tremendous amount of hypocrisy when it comes to that stuff.
Let me get you on one other presidential hopeful before you go, because we talked about how you wrote positively about Barack Obama in your book, and also about Rudy Giuliani, who you also listed his warts, but you say he's worth listening to along with McCain on the Republican side. Not many people praise Obama and Giuliani within two pages of a book. And, of course, you covered New York under Rudy for all those years at Channel 4. You're not done with him?
Well, I think there are different reasons to like some of what Rudy Giuliani brings to the table. I lived through the Dinkins administrations in this town, and I know what the quality of life on these streets in New York was when Rudy Giuliani took over as mayor, and I know what the quality of life was on the streets in New York when Rudy Giuliani left City Hall as mayor, and there was no comparison. And the things he did to organized crime and cleaning up the streets of the city are absolutely commendable. They are accomplishments that no mayor in my 30 years in this city has been able to lay credit to the way he did. So, you know, there's a lot of good about Rudy Giuliani. What I don't like is what I'm hearing now sometimes when he's out campaigning. He's beginning to sound like George Bush when it comes to terrorism and national security, and I'm not so sure I'm ready for another dose of that. But there's a lot I like about Rudy.
Jack Cafferty, His new book, It's Getting Ugly Out There, The Frauds, Bunglers, Liars, and Losers Who Are Hurting America. It's published by Wiley. You can see him in the afternoons on CNN doing his Cafferty Files on the Situation Room. And thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed this.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC coming up in a minute. The MTA looks like they're going to give you a choice as to what kind of fare hike you want. We'll see which one you prefer. None of the above is a choice. Stay with us.